C1PR. Number 22B.
It's true in one case that prayer is something individual, but it has always only one thing in common. It has always one principle of prayer behind it, and not many. And what Mrs. Eddy really shows is only the principle of prayer. She doesn't show the individual. She can't. That's infinite, the individual. But the individual prayer must be based, individuality is a point of life, and life must always be based on principle, or it isn't life. So it must always be based on the principle of prayer. Our individual prayer must all can be individual. It may be different what I do and what you do and the other does, but to be a scientific prayer must always be the based on the same principle of prayer. Now that's what mostly we have tried to see yesterday afternoon, how each prayer, each subject of the chapter on prayer necessitates the preceding subject of prayer. And so how each subject leads to the next one. And that without the next one and the next one to the seventh one, really prayer is not a fulfilled and complete and whole prayer. So there is only one prayer, one principle of prayer. Now, that's a very practical thing, because you may have heard that many times. I have heard it many times anyway in my country, and you may have heard it over here, that many students who have studied the synonymous term and so on, that they say to you, well, I have done a lot of study, but when I'm in trouble, I always go back to my old sense of prayer. I just don't know how to pray in a new way, in the way which has anything which is in rapport to what my study of the synonymous terms. And they say, I still go back to my old sense of prayer, and there I feel happy, and there I feel warm and protected. Well, I can understand that very easily, but I can only understand that very easily as long as we haven't seen the structure of the chapter on prayer. Then things have to change, because up to that point we may not have seen how the seven synonymous terms can be projected to the point of the word as the word, can be reduced in the system to the point of prayer, that we may not have been able to do. But now, where the seven synonymous terms are specifically projected and seen in their specific light as from the point of view of the word as the word, vastly presented in the chapter as the first prayer, second prayer, third, fourth, and so on prayer. Now we know how to pray. Now we know that there is one prayer, and that this one prayer is based on one principle of prayer, and there are not many principles of prayer. This is quite something new. It is a bit shocking to some of us. We feel it's taking away something of our liberty, that we can pray as we like. After all, I have the right to pray as I like. Well, we can't. We can only pray like principle. We can only pray like principle. If we don't pray like principle, we are not in coincidence with principle, and if we are not in coincidence with principle, principle cannot speak through us, and therefore cannot manifest itself through us as life, truth, and love. So there is only one way to pray. Now, one way to pray as a principled way, but always will it be individual. It will be individual, not only individual for me and you, but it will be individual for me every other day. It will be individual because it will be different today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day. It will always be a little bit different, but different on the same principle. Or it isn't praying. It isn't a scientific prayer. See, that's... I come now to one of the most important conclusions which we should draw out of these three sessions. That we begin to realize that just as Jesus had but one brief prayer, which, by the way, Mrs. Eddy says he taught to his disciples. He taught it not just to anybody. She says to his disciples, to those who wanted to be instructed, to those who wanted to think logically, scientifically, not just to the mass of people who didn't want to think. He said, to the thinker, he said, there is one way to pray, and there is only one way to pray. And he gave the Lord's Prayer, which we will see right afterwards, that it is a very clear epitome of the whole chapter on prayer. So, let's come back to the tone here of love, a soul, where she says, Jesus taught his disciples but one brief prayer, which was called after him the Lord's Prayer, the ruler's, the master's prayer, the prayer of the ruler, that which rules our whole life. You see, that's the beauty of it. We have thousands of problems. Should we have thousands of prayers for each one of the problems? That would be a job. That would be a job. To have 10,000 problems in our life and to have 10,000 different prayers in our life to solve that problem, that would be a job. My word. That is not science. Science comes along and says, yes, you have 10,000 different problems, but I show you the underlying system. And it's a simple system, and it's that system which is right for problem 1, problem 2, problem 3, up to the problem 10,000. And the problem 1 up to the problem 10,000 are only specific aspects of the one underlying principle of prayer. Well, what a relief. What a bigness must be in that prayer. What a bigness. To think that we learn in a few months, or try to learn in a few months, the system and the principle of prayer which stays with us through all our life. It isn't just something and then let's get interested in the next chapter, then let's get as quickly interested in the third chapter. No, no. It's something which will stay with us and must stay with us, and which is so vast and so big and so has such a vast range that we hardly can give enough time and consideration to this one system and principle of prayer. It's big. It's just big beyond measure. And yet it's individual to each one of us. Each one of us who goes to the first prayer looks at it individually, and the text talks to him individually. But it's always mind, if he doesn't put his own interpretation into it. And so it is with the second one. And if we don't put our own interpretation into it, or as less as we are aware, and be praying over it, that we don't put as less our own interpretation in it, and it gets always purer and purer until just the principle of prayer speaks through our spiritual sense. That's what she says right afterwards. That is what will be the outcome of such a prayer. So she comes to love as principle and says, you see, what we have to pray about is not 1,000 evils, but one evil, just one evil. And she brings in the phrase, deliver us from evil, the original properly reads, deliver us from the evil one. Deliver us from the evil one. See, again, that universality of love, which says, I'm so universal that I can deliver you from the evil one, and by delivering us from the evil one, it delivers us from the legions of evil. It says, this reading strengthens our scientific apprehension of the petition, for Christian Science teaches us that the evil one, or one evil, is but another name for the first lie, and all liars. See, it covers all liars, and all lies by seeing what? By seeing there is only one evil. What is this one evil? What is this one evil in prayer? This one evil in prayer is not to pray like the principle of prayer. That's the one evil. So going back to any certain kind of prayer which is not principled is the one evil in prayer, the only evil in prayer. And because we have that one evil that we don't pray aright, we have all the liars coming up and they can't be knocked down. Whereas prayer says, I present the one principle of prayer, and if we apprehend in science this one principle of prayer, that frees us from the one evil which says, I don't want to pray the principle way. And by freeing us from the one evil that doesn't want to pray the principled way, we are free from all evil. Because praying principally, we are coming into the sanctuary of spirit and are in heaven, where evil cannot touch us. Now, this is a thing I would like you to think over. It's not a thing I can pour on you. It's not a thing that I can try to convince you, nor should I try to do it. But it's a thing just to propose to you for consideration. What this means. What this means that Jesus taught was one prayer. And that it covers all human needs. That it must cover all human needs. Because the one prayer says your whole and main need and only need is growth in grace. Or as we saw yesterday, it's that longing and desiring to spiritualize thought to reach the stars, reach the signs of Christianity. That's the one prayer. And if we do that one prayer, and if that one prayer becomes our constant attitude from morning, noon, and night, we are in the rhythm of the one prayer, we are in the rhythm of the divine principle. There, evil cannot touch us. So, there is some bigness in this chapter. It's a bigness in it which is scientific, because science is always that which takes the infinitude and reduces it to simplicity. But this simplicity is not just a simplicity, but it's a scientific simplicity. So the promise we have is enormous. The promise we have is that if we understand that principle of prayer and try, if it takes months, if it takes years, to culture these steps and these seven subjects and so on, that the promise is that we are taken into the rhythm and into the rhythm of the divine principle until we coincide with that divine principle, and then the whole floodgates of heaven open and we get the infinite blessing comes down from heaven. So she goes on and takes the last short paragraph in which she depicts life, truth, and love in one paragraph. The subtone of life, truth, and love says, only as we rise above all, you see, it's always all, all material sensuousness and sin, can we reach the heaven-born aspirations. Now the aspiration is heaven-born. And spiritual consciousness, which is indicated in the Lord's Prayer and which instantaneously heals the sick. Now we get to the climax of instantaneously healing the sick. Well, we all like instantaneous healing. I think we all do. But do we like the instantaneous laying down of all material sensation and worship and sin? But that's the condition. It is only as we rise above all material sensation and sin. Only then, she says, that is indicated in the Lord's Prayer and which instantaneously heals the sick. There is always a demand and a supply in prayer. It's always praying and the reward. And we would like to have the reward without paying the price. We like to have instantaneous healing, especially if it concerns ourselves and we are in pain. We like to have it pass away at once. But are we willing to lay all material sensuousness and sin on the altar of love? That's the condition. That's the condition. So let's at least be aware of it and not shrink back because the demand is high. But let's face it and see what love means. Love is either all or nothing. And so it cannot have in the sanctuary of spirit the contemplation of the sinlessness of truth and sinful error. It can't. It's either or. It's all or nothing. But let's see what she says. I think if you go back and read those, especially the last two subjects over, the sixth and seventh subject, we cannot fail seeing that so often Mrs. Eddy brings in some tone of soul. Just as here, you see, she brings in, time after time, she brings in a tone of soul, either in the positive or negative. She speaks of the rejoicing, which is an idea of soul, then of the sacrifice of all material things, arising above all material sensuousness and sin. See, we get the sense, what she says here, yes, unless we have that wonderful attitude, which has been described in the scriptural note, as the word, where through desire, mind, and through exhibiting that desire with all our best qualities, and reaching out and upward to identification with soul, therefore being willing to rebuke in us sin, to let the sensual and the sinful behind ourselves. Unless we do that, we come... I started again with unless. I never know how to go afterwards. I only know that afterwards must be a positive verb, so I... if we... Sorry, but sometimes my English just isn't good enough. See, what she says is that only through embodying that attitude of the word as the word, which we saw yesterday, which reaches the point of soul, that lifts us above the false sense in us, the false sense of self-centeredness, because that in us which is the false prayer, really always wants something selfish. We pray something for us or for the other, but it's always for somebody. It isn't free, completely free from self. And so here in these last few pages, she stresses that more and more and says, let's go of the sense, of sinful sense, of sensuousness, of all, let's have that sacrifice of material things. And only then are we lifted out, as she says here, to that point where God can speak to us. Then we have heaven-born aspirations. Then the aspirations are no more from the human. Then we no more think out what we should have and what would be the best. Even if we think it out, what would be the best divinely, then it's a higher sense where heaven has born in us a new aspiration, a higher aspiration, a lovelier aspiration. And so the wheel turns and we come from love again back to mind, to the seeking, to the first prayer, to seek from a heaven-born aspiration, to seek God from a heaven-born intention, and with a heaven-born purpose, and with a heaven-born motive, and we start all over again, but on a higher plane. Love always gives the hand back to mind, but then we start on a higher plane. So, this last prayer of love, you can ponder it a little bit at home, and as you ponder it, you will feel how it is a sense of magnifying the Lord, of, you say, eulogizing, yes, of glorifying the Lord, of rejoicing in it. Mrs. Nelson gave me a wonderful definition from Emerson on prayer. Emerson must have said that prayer is a soliloquy of the beholding and jubilant soul. And that's what here in the last prayer is brought out so wonderfully. See, it's the soliloquy. It's knowing for oneself the wonders of love. And it's beholding it in all its bigness. But it's not only beholding, it's being jubilant in it. It's more than beholding. When we behold, it's far away. If we are jubilant in it, then we have that attitude of the Word of the Word, where it has become, that beholding has become definite in us, that it has become reality in us, that it has been born in us out of our own loins. It's us. And then we are rejoicing and jubilant in it. And then all that sense of fear that we may not be saved, that our prayers may not be answered, that all that then is excluded, gives a sense, a great sense, that love excludes the fear of being excluded. That love excludes the fear that we may not make our demonstration. In mind, it says, it excludes that fear that we may not be chosen. We are chosen. In spirit, excludes that fear that we may not wish and do the right thing. Love, as spirit, says, well, I wipe pretty well away all what is not right, and I only fulfill that which is right and good. And in soul, it does exclude my fear that my need may not be met. And in the subtone of principle, it excludes my fear that I may not know the right answer to the specific evil. I will know it, because love is all. and there is only one evil, namely that evil which doesn't want to go the way of the prayer, of this principal prayer. And in life it excludes me that fear which fears that I cannot go higher, that I will make no progress, that the way will not go brighter and brighter. And in truth, it excludes that fear that I may not get spiritual consciousness, that spiritual consciousness is something far-reaching and not something present, and that it isn't for me, and that it doesn't come to me. And in the subtone of love, it excludes that fear which delivers me from the fear that any form or shape or disease can ever be the master over me, and that I couldn't be delivered from evil in any shape and form. It just wipes it out. Because why? It builds on the trustworthiness. It builds on the trustworthiness which through all the conscious prayer of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 prayer, through the consciousness of that prayer, I can really say, well, what is there more than God? What is there more than all that which is in the sanctuary of spirit? There isn't anything anymore besides that. And so I can trust in the allness and infinitude and bigness and grandeur and magnitude of the divine. I can trust it. And by trusting it fully, but consciously, not blindly, you see, it's no more a blind trust, God has a chance through His Christ to give me what I need, what I divinely